My name is Caroline Cape, and today I'll be interviewing Ernie Lewis here at the Department of Public Advocacy in Frankfort, Kentucky. It is August 9th, 2012, and this interview with Mr. Lewis is in regards to the history of the department, as well as his involvement and experiences with the agency.
When did you become come to the Public Defender's Office, and why did you choose this office?
Moved to Kentucky. I was a Washington University law student, and my then wife was admitted to the University of Kentucky Medical School, and so Washington U allowed me to be a visiting student at UK for my third year. And I wanted to be a legal services lawyer. I had decided long before that that I wanted to be a poverty lawyer, and what that meant to me was civil law. There wasn't a legal services office in Lexington at the time, so I started here as a law clerk in my third year at UK, October of 1976, and I worked as a law clerk for Bill Ayer and Ernesto Scorsone and Dave Norat. I did 1142s and habeas corpuses, and then during the summer of 1977, I interviewed with Jack Farley for a permanent position. During that summer, after graduating from law school, I was Ed's law clerk and Bill Radigan's law clerk. An interview, by the way, with Jack Farley essentially meant that you sat in his office for about an hour and a half and he talked. But after I listened to him for an hour and a half, he hired me. And so I was sworn in, barred in October and November of 1977. I decided to switch from civil legal services over to public defense, primarily because there wasn't a civil legal services office in Central Kentucky. I was tied there because my wife was a medical student, and also because I really started liking it, doing post-conviction initially, and then I was hired as an appellate lawyer in 1977.
Appellate work, post-conviction, was that primary responsibilities before you became the public advocate, or was there other...
What I did is from 1977 until 1980, I was an appellate lawyer. DPA was primarily an appellate office. It had a very small post-conviction branch. There, 78, 79, P&A was established, but it was mostly an appellate office. So I was an appellate attorney from 77 to... really, I think 79 or 80. And then long about 79 or 80, the public advocate, Jack Farley, started something called the Local Assistance Branch. Ed was the director of the Local Assistance Branch. What the Local Assistance Branch did was to really oversee all of the counties. And there were five of us, I believe. So the state was divided up between the five of us, and we oversaw each of us some 20 to 23 or 4 counties. We were supposed to get to know that county. My memory is we had ADD districts, area development districts, that we were in charge of. I was in charge of the Bluegrass and the Far Western. I got 2 ADDs. I believe Ed was in charge of Northern Kentucky. Then there were three other people that did that. Local Assistance Branch not only did oversight of the systems that were in place in the 120 counties, and there were assigned council systems primarily until 1980. But we also started education. We started we worked on the death penalty. We began to do death penalty training. Created a death penalty task force. I mean, that was the area of the department where there was an awful lot of ferment, an awful lot of creativity. I did that from 1980 until 1983. At some point in there, I became the director of the local assistance branch that was renamed the trial services branch, and Ed became director of training. I don't remember the year where you were named that, but so starting in 1983, my wife had graduated from medical school and finished her residency, and we moved to Richmond. Long about the same time, the Madison County Bar Association decided they no longer wanted the system that was in place there. So then the new public advocate, Paul Isaacs, decided to open an office in Richmond. So in 1983, I think late 83, early 84, I opened the Richmond Public Defender's Office. I was by myself. We had an office in the local library. I went to do interviews for a secretary, and hired a woman named Debbie Garrison, who was at the Department of Criminal Justice training at the time. And for a while, it was me and her. I remember for probably two months. For about a month, we didn't have an office, so I carried all the case files in the back of my car. And then we got an office, and we didn't have any furniture. So Debbie sat on the floor and answered the phone, and I sat on the floor and did what I did. I went around to every lawyer in Madison County and talked to them. And the deal was I was going to do all the felonies, and I was going to get a group of lawyers to do the misdemeanors. And so that's how we started the Richmond office. From there, that was 1983, I ran the Richmond office from 1983 until 1996. I was also a regional manager. We started a regional manager program after the Pumpkin Creek Lodge Revolution in about 1986, and that stayed in place until about 1993 or so, and I was the regional manager of the Central Kentucky region. In 1992 or 3, Allison Connolly, then the public advocate, abolished the regional manager system and began to manage the trial system in a different way. She had a trial director and a contract lawyer director. And I then just ran the Richmond office. And then for about 9 months, and I believe it was 1994, I became the trial division director for her, but left, resigned when I didn't believe that she was committed to converting to a complete full-time system. I saw the system that she was developing in a different way than she did. So I went back until 96 to just run the Richmond office. Then in 96, I became the public advocate in October and was appointed three times. First, 1996, and was Paul Patton. 2000 was Paul Patton, the governor. And then in 2004, Ernie Fletcher was the governor, and he appointed me to a third term. And then I retired in the end of August, last day of August in 2008.
So you mentioned the Richmond office. Can you tell us a little bit more as far as going out and meeting with the attorneys or any difficulties you had?
We got a lot of support from the bar, particularly a law firm run by Charlie Coy, who had been a former president of the bar. Larry Greathouse, who had been the general counsel for Wendell Ford, was a local lawyer there at the time, and he helped me out a great deal. The primary opposition came from the circuit judge at the time, Jim Chenault. He very clearly did not want an office there. Prior to that, Judge Chenault had run the public defender system virtually. He had a court administrator by the name of Tom Harkelrode, who was his court administrator, but was also the public defender administrator. Sadly, a couple of years before that, maybe maybe 3 or 4 years before that, Tom Harkleroad had appointed Jerry Fish to Harold McQueen's capital case. Actually, Chenault had done that, but Tom Harkleroad was the court administrator. Harkleroad eventually became the pretrial, head pretrial release officer in that jurisdiction. But Chenault appointed a guy named Jerry Fish, who was an alcoholic lawyer in Berea, as the sole lawyer to represent Harold McQueen. Fish was paid $1,000 to represent him. McQueen got death. McQueen was the only lawyer, or McQueen was the only involuntary execution we've had in Kentucky. When I got there, the 1142 in McQueen's case was ongoing. Chenault wrote a scurrilous opinion about DPA, about our lawyers. He kicked Danny Dees out of town. He didn't have the authority to do that, obviously, but Dees was trying to interview jurors at the time, the jurors in the Harold McQueen case. And he brought Dees in and told him to get out, told all the jurors they didn't have to talk. When I started the office there, one of the first things I did was go to him and tried to talk to him. He wouldn't talk to me, so I talked to Carol Konelsky, his secretary, and I probably tried 3 or 4 times to set up an appointment with Judge Chenault, simply to talk about the system, talk about how we were going to run that system. He was chief circuit judge over Clark and Madison, that's Winchester and Richmond. And he would never meet with me, and we battled until he retired. We battled from 1983 until he retired in 95, I believe, right before I became public advocate. When he retired, Bill Jennings became the chief circuit judge there, and he gave me a book on the U.S. Constitution, written by James Michener. And in the front of it, he said, you know, please uphold the Constitution. Bill Jennings would never confront Jim Chenault, but I know that he did that because he saw how Chenault had treated me over the years. One memorable part of that was one time a new law had been passed in Kentucky, the Truth in Sentencing Law, I believe it was 86, 87. And it had a very vague portion of the law in there, one that made it very difficult to negotiate. And so I asked Chenault to declare the statute unconstitutional. And rather than just declaring or overruling my motion, he took a Rule 11 against me, actually he overruled me. So I took a writ to ask the Court of Appeals to declare it unconstitutional. And that's when he asked the Court of Appeals to Rule 11 me. And I asked Ed to represent me. And so Ed represented me in the Court of Appeals. We lost in the Court of Appeals in the Kentucky Supreme Court. The case was dismissed when a companion case went our way. So not only was my action not frivolous, it was correct. And Ed did a marvelous job representing me. So that was one of a whole bunch of challenges in the Richmond office, opening that office, making sure that we had a system that worked, trying to establish an office in the middle of a tyrannical, high-control circuit judge. Prepared me for seeing the judges in New Orleans, by the way.
Tell us about starting the Advocate and the Trial Practice Institute.
Okay. I believe it was about 1978. Jack Farley, the public advocate, wanted to have a newsletter, sort of a law review or a newsletter. And Jack had asked Vince April to put one out. And my memory is that they weren't real timely. So eventually he asked me to start putting the Advocate out, and I put the Advocate out from about 78 until I think it was about 83. I have distinct memories. I had no training in journalism or anything else, but distinct memories of cutting and pasting the Advocate at my house, you know, trying to figure out what was on what page. It was a very rudimentary newsletter. I think it was 4 pages long. We probably did it 8.5 by 17 and folded it, so it was 4 pages. If you go back to the early editions, that's probably what it looks like. It's very simplistic. We used to have cartoons in it. Bill Spicer would draw cartoons. I think you drew a cartoon or two. Yeah. Didn't you?
I hope.
I think you did. And if you look at later editions, Ed became the editor in 83, I think, and made it into a first-rate sort of law review quality kind of organ. So that was the Advocate. And I'm real proud of the fact that it started in 78. We never missed. It went 6 times a year. I think we started it at 6 times a year. And I think it's still doing that. Trial Practice Institute. I went to the National College of Criminal Defense, NCCD, that was located in Houston, Texas at the time in 1978. It was later changed to the National Criminal Defense College, NCDC, after the NCCD went bankrupt. And it moved from Houston to Macon, and that's where it still is. I started teaching there in 1985 and have taught there ever since. But I went there. It was this incredible experience, 2-week-long trial practice institute. Ed went there in 79, 1 year later. Both of us, as appellate lawyers, basically had seen case after case after case of trial lawyers who didn't know what they were doing. Because when you read appeals, what you're reading is losses, lawyers who lose, essentially. And the quality, I didn't think the quality of trial practice was very high. Ed came back from Houston. I had been there the previous year, and the two of us had a conversation. He and I probably dispute whose idea it was, but in coming out of that conversation, I think he started it, but he says otherwise. Coming out of that conversation came the idea to start a trial practice institute. I think our first year was 1982. The reason I think that is my son was born in July of 1982, and I thought our first one of those was at Eastern Kentucky University, there in the same building as the planetarium, and I had my baby in my arms as a lot of that was going on. So I believe 82 was the first year. We were there a couple of years, and I think we were at a hotel in Louisville 1 year, I believe a Holiday Inn, off Hurstbourne Lane. And then sometime in the mid-80s, we moved to Fawbush, to the Kentucky Leadership Center, which is our present location for that. It's been a week long ever since it began, as I recall. It may not have been a week long the first couple of times, but it soon settled into a week-long format.
What's the significance of the Institute?
Well, I think I've said a lot of times that the Institute is the soul of DPA. And by that, I mean it sort of carries a symbolic, it's a symbolic representation of what we stand for, standing for high-quality, excellent client representation, arming our lawyers with what they need to represent clients in a vigorous and excellent way. And every year that torch has been passed down from one lawyer to another. Every lawyer, every trial lawyer who's come through DPA has gone to that. So that's the significance of it.
When did you serve as public advocate? How was you appointed?
I served as public advocate from 96 to 2008. I really wanted to become public advocate in 92. I didn't want to become public advocate in 96. In 92, I was one of the three names that had been sent up to the commission, along with Vince April and Allison Conley. And when I felt ready at that point. I had lots of ideas in 92. When I didn't get it, I was a little disillusioned and just said, you know, I want to stay out of the politics of DPA from now on, and sort of was resolute in so doing. But in 96, my memory is that I think I was playing Hamlet at the time. I didn't know whether I wanted to or not, and Bob Ewald called me up during the summer of 96 and asked me to put my name in, and I agreed to do that. What had happened previously is that Allison Conley's four-year tenure had ended when she got into a lot of conflict with a newly elected governor, Paul Patton. Apparently, Patton had run with a particular position on gun control. I think he was opposed to it fairly strongly, and I believe Allison Conley, who had been appointed by Brereton Jones, the previous governor. I believe that's right. I didn't think Wallace Wilkinson appointed her. So Governor Patton had not appointed Allison, and I later found some documents that said that one of his goals was to change public advocate. Patton intended to make a change in who the public advocate was, because of the election. But then as soon as he came in, he signed a bunch of death warrants, and there was a lot of conflict between Allison Conley and Vince April and the new Public Protection Regulation Cabinet Secretary, Laura Douglas. So that as a result of all that, there was a lot of controversy and a lot of anger, and that's the context in which I was appointed.
Why did you want to take on the responsibility, especially with all this going on?
I'd been a public defender for 19 years, so I felt ready in 92, but I felt ready again in 96. To know why I was willing to take it on, you'd have to go back to the early 80s. One of the neat things the local assistance branch, trial services branch, did was we put together a full-time plan. All of us who were overseeing the 120 counties became convinced, I think we all did, became convinced that the assigned counsel system was an inferior method for delivering services, and became convinced that the full-time method was the superior way to do that. So we came up with a plan. Jack Farley, the public advocate at the time, was a big believer in the full-time method. It was his vision, I think, eventually to have a full-time system in all the counties. So he went with that notion and presented it to the legislature, and we helped him present it to the legislature. My memory is I testified before some committee, probably a budget review committee, in 1981 or 1982, and it was passed. So we got a full-time system. And then the local assistance branch interviewed. We decided where all the offices were going to be. My memory is we hired 40 or 50 lawyers. Is that too many? Do you remember? We hired a whole bunch of lawyers, made job offers. And then John Y. Brown came in as a governor, and there was a budget crisis. This was during the Reagan recession, and he decided we were not going to be allowed to go forward, and totally eliminated that full-time method, so that no new offices would go forward as of 81 or 82. And so you'll see when you look at the development of the full-time system in Kentucky from 1981-82 to 1996, you'd have an office added Usually it was added when the local system just broke down and there wasn't an alternative. During Paul Isaac's era, he did not really push the full-time system. Jack Farley believed in it a lot, and in my opinion, Jack Farley was probably lost his job because of that. So when I came in 96, I felt, both in 92 and 96, I felt committed to that vision and wanted to advance that vision. So that's why I wanted to take over that responsibility.
And speaking of the full-time method of delivering services, how did you see that as being the better model?
I remain convinced that it's the better model. What the full-time, particularly in a situation where you don't have a lot of funding, you can have lots of different methods. Massachusetts is a good example of a combination of full-time method with private lawyers. But you have to have a whole lot of money to pay private lawyers to handle the public defender system. If you don't have a lot of money, the full-time method, I'm convinced, is the most cost-efficient method, primarily because your full-time lawyers don't have a financial incentive to cut corners. A contract lawyer, which contract attorneys began in 1982 when the assigned counsel system was abolished, 1982 the contract system came in. Those lawyers were paid a set sum of money to handle all the cases. They had a financial incentive to plead everybody guilty and not spend much time on the case. Our full-time lawyers did not have that financial system. Secondly, they were our employees, so we could oversee them, control them for excellence. Three, we could insist on their training. If we had bad ones, we could get rid of them immediately. Contract method, you would have to wait. Usually you'd have to wait until the end of the year and recontract. But financially, Kentucky could have never afforded to pay enough to attract the best lawyers in the state to do public defender work unless they were our own employees. And I think we accomplished that. Eventually, I think the public defenders in Kentucky, by and large, are the best criminal defense lawyers in the state.
Which that sounds like it was a big challenge. What other big challenges did you face?
Well, the biggest challenge in Kentucky overall is and has been funding. We were funded at the time at about, when I came in 96, probably $3 per capita. I think that's about right. 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. I think our funding was $16 million, so that was a little over $4 per capita. We were almost last in the nation in per capita funding. We're a poor state, so we've never been able to get the funding level up enough. And I came in thinking that I would be able to accomplish a lot substantively in terms of criminal defense reform. I soon discovered that my primary job was going to be raising money. And if I step back and look at my 12 years as public advocate, that's essentially what I did. Every 2 years I had a different campaign with a different name, the goal of which was to increase funding. And we did that. We increased funding from $16 million up to about $40, $41, $42 when I left. Although they cut it back to about $38, I think, in the last General Assembly that I was public advocate. So that's the biggest challenge. The second challenge was the Harold McQueen execution. I started in October of 96. A warrant was issued in Harold McQueen's case. Remember, Harold McQueen is the same guy his lawyer was paid $1,000 in Madison County. McQueen's lawyers, who were in our department, began to make some pretty extraordinary and foolish allegations against me and Ed and Vince April and Rebecca DiLoretto, saying that we had conspired back in the late 70s to deny Harold McQueen his rights. And eventually, all of the claims failed. Harold McQueen was executed in early July 1997, or late June 1997. Those allegations and the execution about tore the department apart. So that was my biggest challenge right there. Looking back on it, it's understandable that it happened because it was our only involuntary execution. We had a death penalty task force starting in 1976 that had fought for 20 years to keep people off death row, and we probably had some hubris in all of that, thinking we would never have an execution in Kentucky, thinking by force of will and intellect and hard work we would be able to keep the death penalty from ever being implemented. And so when that happened, fingers started being pointed. I asked, and the Public Advocacy Commission authorized a former judge to conduct an investigation as to whether we had conspired to have Harold McQueen killed. He didn't find any evidence of that. I didn't feel like I could serve if under that kind of allegation. So eventually, people were disciplined for making allegations without sufficient investigation. We then established a goal of becoming more professional and more excellent because there was a lot of unprofessionalism during that period of time. And out of that, I think the department grew a great deal, matured a great deal, became more professional, became more of a player in the criminal justice system. But it was out of that particular crisis. So that was a second big challenge. Also that summer, a couple of weeks after McQueen was executed, the Justice Cabinet came in July, a couple of weeks later, and said that they were going to defund the Capital Resource Center. Capital Resource Center was a federally funded, grant-funded group that had been in our department since, I believe, 1989. And they took away all federal funding. So that meant, and we were representing, if not everybody on death row, almost everybody on death row, and all of a sudden we didn't have funding to do that any longer. And so that was a huge challenge. The Paul Patton, who had signed all those death warrants, finally put into the budget in 1998 funding for capital post-conviction. His cabinet secretary, Laura Douglas, and I established a good relationship, and she agreed to go to Paul Patton to convince him to restore funding that had been taken away by the federal government, restore funding to us. And he did, and Capital Resource Center was replaced by the Capital Post-Conviction Branch. I would say those were the biggest challenges. Being public advocate is one challenge after another, so it's a little difficult to identify any unique challenge, but those were the main ones.
So what was your values and visions for the DPA program?
When I became public advocate?
Yes.
The primary value was one of being client-centered and being excellent, professional and excellent. It was a value we continued to hold up all the time during the years that followed. The primary vision was to convert from being a mixed system with 47 counties full-time, 73 counties as part-time, to all 120 counties being part of a full-time office, because that fit into the excellence that we were driving for. At some point, we began to express the vision or the value as one of being client-centered. I don't think that was one we articulated in 1996, but we soon developed that. Another value that came in at some point was the whole client. That was probably a value we started expressing maybe 2002 or three, whereby we were talking about more than just representing the client on one particular charge, but representing him in all of his, sort of his whole milieu, if he had a housing problem or collateral consequences or heroin addiction or whatever it was. We wanted to begin to try to address his criminogenic needs as opposed to just the particular charge. I had three goals because as a trial lawyer for those 13 years, I was convinced that that we needed to have a full-time system. So that was goal number one. Goal number two was to lower our caseloads. I was convinced that that was our A number one problem. If we were going to become a full-time system, caseloads were going to be our constant problem. And three was our salaries. When I came in as public advocate, our salaries were $22,000 as a starting salary, that was grossly low, and that became a goal. We had that as a third goal. So,
And with the workload issues, I guess the realities of it during your tender, how was the workload?
We tackled all three of those problems sort of together because the full-time method meant that caseloads were going to be our primary problem. And if we were going to have a full-time system, we also had to have salaries that were decent. So we tackled all three of them simultaneously. I mentioned before that I kind of divided up my tenure into two-year increments based upon when the General Assembly was going to meet. And I would have a theme and a sort of a slogan for every 2 years. And the first one was in 1998, where we had where we talked about Plan 2000. And we were attempting to drive more of the full-time system during that particular campaign. The Blue Ribbon Group was 1999, a year after that, and we tackled all three of those issues in the Blue Ribbon Group and made a lot of advances through the report of the Blue Ribbon Group on all three fronts. In fact, the Blue Ribbon Group, those two campaigns together, 98 and 2000, set the stage for completing the full-time system. Blue Ribbon Group got our salaries up. At the time, now it doesn't seem like much, but at the time it seemed like a lot. We got our salaries from $21,000 up to $29,000. And during Paul Patton's tenure, he developed a method for increasing salaries based upon the cost of living so that by the time he left, our salaries were up around $37,000, $38,000, which is about where they are right now. They really haven't advanced since Paul Patton left in 2003. Caseloads, workload, remained our biggest problem, so that by 2004, when our caseloads were up around 498 new cases per lawyer per year, Public Advocacy Commission said, we got to do something about that. And that's when the Justice Jeopardize campaign began. The Justice Jeopardize campaign was 2 years long. It consisted of five public meetings. The Public Advocacy Commission would, whoever from the commission could show up, would hold a public hearing. And the hearing began always with a Supreme Court judge, justice, or a Court of Appeals judge introducing it, endorsing it. We would have prosecutors, criminal justice officials, employees coming. We had five meetings in five different parts of the state. And out of that came the Justice Jeopardized report, which was written in about 2005, presented to the commission. Then that report was then presented to Governor Fletcher, and we got a nice big boost in addition to a social worker pilot project out of that. But throughout, every time it seemed like we would move ahead on caseloads, we would get a boost. We'd get caseloads down from 500 down to closer to 400. Caseloads would continue to rise. It was almost if you build it, they will come. It's almost if you have the lawyers there, the infrastructure there, the courts will appoint lawyers to more and more and more people. One of the realizations that I think Ed had in the early 90s and I had is that there were literally tens of thousands of people, particularly misdemeanants, who were not getting lawyers, who were simply having to go to being charged with a crime, some of them going to jail, who had no lawyer. And what was occurring in our system, particularly prior to the full-time system, was that judges were forcing them to handle the case themselves. Once the full-time system came into place, we had directing attorneys whose responsibility was to oversee the system to make sure eligible people were being appointed, and that's what drove the problem of increasing caseloads. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell us about the Public Advocacy Commission's deciding to have the full-time public defender system.
I actually don't know much about that. I was a trial lawyer at the time. I certainly believed in the full-time system. The full-time method had been something that I supported in the early 80s, and I've already talked about that, something Jack Farley certainly supported. I would have been communicating with some commission members. I know Bob Caron was somebody who I communicated with. I feel certain I had conversations encouraging them to do that, but how that came about, where there was a resolution to move completely to full-time, I really don't recall. Let me say one other thing, though. When I became public advocate in 96, the fact that they had done that was probably the most important thing that I could rely upon for authorization. The reason for that is in 94, there was a governor's task force that did not fully endorse the full-time method. That's one of the reasons I left the job as trial division director. But once I became public advocate, that resolution saying, let's go to full-time, still existed. And I had the support of the commission to do that. So that was a vital part of moving forward on trying to get the full-time system completed.
Tell us about the significant structural changes that you've made to the department, okay, other than what we've already discussed.
Yeah. I established divisions, the four division structure that we have now with a trial division, a post-trial division, P&A, and law operations. I reinstituted the regional manager system that had been abolished by Allison in the early 90s. I brought that back in. I made general counsel a non-merit general counsel. I established the Kentucky Innocence Project as part of the post-trial division. I survived from moving from the Public Protection Regulation Cabinet into the Environmental Protection Cabinet for a brief period of time. And then into the Justice Cabinet, where we entered into a memorandum of agreement guaranteeing our independence. We elevated the training director up to leadership, where that role became part of the leadership team, which I thought was really important. I think those were the primary structural changes that we made during my 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Who were the key players within the criminal justice system when you was the public advocate?
And that one, I really, you know, there were so many people, so I would leave people out. But the primary ones that helped us anyway, Bob Stevens, who was long-term, he was the Attorney General, then he was the Justice of the Supreme Court, long-term Chief Justice of the Kentucky Supreme Court, became a huge supporter of ours, and eventually became Justice Cabinet Secretary when the Criminal Justice Council was instituted. The Governor's Criminal Justice Response Team was something Paul Patton started in the summer of 1997. I was not named a part of that initially, and I asked the Governor's General Counsel to be made part of that. Dennis Fleming was his name. And so I was made, along with Dan Goyette, part of the governor's criminal justice response team. I got to know a lot of the players during that 12, 14-month process. Out of that came House Bill 455, passed in 1998, establishing the Kentucky Criminal Justice Council. And for a period of about 4 or 5 years, that council met repeatedly. The council was large. There were 33 members to the Criminal Justice Council that included jailers, clerks, all the departments of the Justice Cabinet, legislators, trial judges, prosecutors, public defenders, and so forth. So there for a period of about 98 till about 2003, all of the players in the criminal justice system got together monthly and talked about the problems in the criminal justice system. So if you ask who were the players, they were all there during that period of time. Bob Stevens was a major force in the development of the Criminal Justice Council. His executive director was Kim Allen, who's now in Louisville. I believe public safety is her role. She was a major player in the council. Joe Lambert followed Bob Stevens as Chief Justice, and Joe Lambert, along with Jim Deckard and Jason Nemus, people, his assistants, were tremendously supportive of the growth of public advocacy and adequate funding for public advocacy. Both Bob Stevens and Joe Lambert served Lambert served on the Blue Ribbon Group. Paul Patton, I need to tell this story as part of that. When Allison was not reappointed and I became public advocate, Paul Patton asked Bob Stevens to come see him. And Paul Patton said to Bob Stevens, "We've got to do something about public advocacy." And Bob said, and Bob told me this as he was dying some years later. Patton said, "They get too much money and they're out of control." And Stevens said, "Paul, that's ridiculous. They don't get enough money." And it was his influence that turned Paul Patton around, because eventually Paul Patton became convinced that we were underfunded, gave us more money in 1998, gave us more money in 2000, gave us more money in 2002. When the cuts started after the recession of 2000, 2001, we were exempted from those cuts during that period of time. Patton, in fact, one time announcing what was going at a press conference, asked me to speak to talk about how difficult the cuts that were taking place, how difficult that was going to be, and the effect it had on the criminal justice system. I go into that detail to show how important Bob Stevens was to the growth of public advocacy. He totally turned around Governor Patton and made Governor Patton a supporter of ours. And then by his leadership in the Kentucky Criminal Justice Council, he allowed us to become a player. The Blue Ribbon Group met in 1999, issued a report. I presented that report to the Criminal Justice Council. The Criminal Justice Council endorsed it, and that report then went to the governor. I continue to attribute that to our growth in 2000. The Blue Ribbon Group resulted in our getting $6 million more dollars and most of the rest of the full-time system. In Paul Patton's desk, I was told later by one of his budget analysts, he had the amount that was going to take to complete the full-time system, and he put it into his desk and made a commitment to finish the full-time system. And then Paul Patton had an affair, and he was shamed. And the recession hit, and his power was reduced, and that never happened. But he and Bob Stevens, Joe Lambert, the three of them really went a long way toward building our system. Steve Pence, Lieutenant Governor under Governor Fletcher, Cleve Gamble, Governor Fletcher himself were also primary supporters of ours while I was public advocate.
Laura Douglas was cabinet secretary at one point, and the governor had a juvenile initiative. What role did she play?
Yeah. I mentioned Plan 2000. In 1997, I asked Bob Spangenberg to come in and do a report for us, and he did a very brief report for us saying that Plan 2000 was a very responsible way to proceed. Laura Douglas was the Public Protection Regulation Cabinet Secretary when I became public advocate. She was Paul Patton's appointed Cabinet Secretary. She recommended that we tie our budget request into a juvenile initiative that eventually was called the GALT Initiative. And so part of the 1998 budget was tied to increasing the quality of representation in juvenile court. One reason that she said that, one reason we were able to be successful at that, is that there had been an assessment by the American Bar Association and the Children's Law Center in Northern Kentucky saying that our juvenile representation in Kentucky was terrible. And that came out in 1995 or 96, right before I became public advocate. So it was Laura Douglas's very astute leadership that said to us, tie your budget request to improving juvenile representation. Thanks for remembering that.
So was there any political enemies of the DPA?
You know, I'm not sure we had enemies. I've left out some people and friends, I'll go back to them. But I would say the primary enemy of DPA over the years, the person who most opposed parity, most opposed our role in a wide variety of ways, was the Commonwealth's attorney in Fayette County, Ray Larson. Larson opposed everything we tried to do on the Criminal Justice Council. He went so far as to begin to take pictures of people on the Criminal Justice Council at Criminal Justice Council meetings and posting them on his website, Kentucky Prosecutors. He declared members of the council outrages of the month. He has an outrage of the month part of his website. He's very destructive to a decent criminal justice system. In a sense, I would say that he was our only real enemy. There were other people who were impediments, barriers. Certainly, present president of the Senate, David Williams, has been a barrier. He and Robert Stivers, who was in leadership also in 2008, when they cut our budget leading to the lawsuit of 2008, they viewed our system in a way differently than I did. I wouldn't call them enemies. They've both done criminal defense. I would call Ray Larson an enemy. Let me see if I've left out any people who were supporters. Certainly our Public Advocacy Commission has been highly supportive from the beginning. We've had trial judges like Judge Paisley, Judge Isaacs, Phil Patton. We've had legislators who've been supportive like Kathy Stein, Robin Webb, Jeff Hoover, Jim Wayne, Gerald Neal, Jim Lovell, Jesse Crenshaw, and others. We've had cabinet secretaries like Laura Douglas, Ron McLeod, Cleve Gamble, Mike Brown, law professors, including Robert Lawson. Lawson's been one of the most supportive in among all Kentuckians. Ben Chandler was a very supportive attorney general during his time. And then surprisingly, during the administration of Ernie Fletcher, his chief administrator, Stan Cave, his general counsel, Dave Fleener, his lieutenant governor, Steve Pence, all of them were really, really supportive. So we didn't have many enemies. We mostly had supporters.
That's good. You mentioned the Kentucky Innocent Project, and you got that put into action. What other programs and changes, organizational changes, did you make? And tell us a little about getting Kentucky Innocent Project.
Yeah, the primary program and organizational changes would have been saving the Capitol post-conviction branch after the Resource Center was closed in 97, moving to four divisions, which clarified management structure, elevating education, Having a leadership team consisting of the education leader, the deputy public advocate, Ed Monahan, our four division directors, having that entity meet on a weekly basis and guide, set priorities, guide planning was important. Establishing the value of professionalism and excellence, and Ed Monahan was a leader in that. He brought a sort of a task force together to talk about how we could become more professional and excellent. Establishing the independence of P&A, protection and advocacy, in my view, was deserved to be independent of DPA, almost completely independent, similar to the way we were independent within the first the Public Protection Regulation Cabinet and then the Justice Cabinet. The Galt Initiative was big, whereby we began to elevate people who wanted to do juvenile representation. That was a real important development prior to that time. And sadly, while I was directing Attorney of Richmond, we viewed people who did juvenile representation as lesser lawyers. It was sort of baby lawyers, you know. And then they grew up to go to adult court. That changed. And a lot of us had our eyes opened, and we began to treat people who wanted to represent juveniles as a specialty. And we wanted them to have specialized training. Juvenile post-disposition branch was established while I was public advocate, and it grew. The Blue Ribbon Group we've already talked about. The Justice Jeopardized campaign we've talked about. And then the Kentucky Innocence Project. The Kentucky Innocence Project was an idea that I had after reading an article in The Champion, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers magazine. And I took that, I'm sure, to Ed, but also to our post-trial division and Rebecca DiLoretto and Marguerite Thomas. I charged them with the task of developing that, and they, with others, then developed the Kentucky Innocence Project.
Did you view the Kentucky Innocence Project as a separate entity apart from DPA or as part of the post-conviction?
No, I absolutely made it part of the post-trial division. We struggled with the notion of should it be part of the post-conviction branch or a separate branch of the post-trial division. There were some in the Kentucky Innocence Project who thought that it should be separate, should have a separate website, should have its own logo, should really have its independent, should have an independent status, and I resisted that. I thought it absolutely needed to be a part of DPA, part of the post-trial division.
Would you also talk some about the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers?
The Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers was an idea that I and you and Kevin and Gail and Vince April all had after 1985 General Assembly, as I recall. There had been a homicide in Jefferson County where two young white men were killed by two young black men, and they both received the death penalty, and there was a lot of outrage that developed over those two homicides. And major structural changes in the law occurred in the 86 General Assembly. CARES 439-3401 and 532-055 were radically changed so that a new procedure began occurring after a trial where there would be a separate hearing where additional evidence could be brought in about parole eligibility and that sort of thing. A bunch of us realized that the defense was not being heard in the General Assembly, and so we started meeting a bunch of public defenders, and my memory is the leaders of it were me and you and Gail, and to some extent Kevin. Met with Bill Johnson and Charlie Coy and Frank Haddad and Burl McCoy and some other private lawyers, and we organized a board. Mike Maloney organized a board, and from that grew the Kentucky Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers that now has over 300 criminal defense lawyers. We have a lobbyist. We've got an executive director. And we're recognized as one of the important policy players in criminal justice matters. And that grew out of DPA.
Why is KECDL important to public defenders?
Well, it's real important to public defenders because DPA is inside state government. And sometimes the public advocate cannot speak to a particular issue because it may have ramifications for the agency, because it's a part of state government. Usually, KCDL and DPA's interests coincide. So KCDL can speak in a way that DPA cannot on controversial matters.
And you mentioned Gail and Kevin. Is that Gail Robinson and
Gail Robinson and Kevin McNally.
Okay.
Who, by the way, were part of the original local assistance branch. It's amazing how many people were in the local assistance branch that later became leaders in DPA. It really was a group of young, creative, energetic lawyers who wanted to change the world that were in DPA in the late 70s.
You mentioned leadership and excellence. What key characteristics of public defender leadership would you say there are?
Okay. That's number 22. Okay. I've got about 8 or 10 that I really think are important. I mean, I think a public defender leader has to be client-centered. I think that's sort of the theory of the case for a good public defender leader, is everything has to be about the client. I think a second trait is that they have to see the world from different perspectives. The four frames is sort of a way to look at that, where you look at the world from a political and a symbolic and a human resources and a structural perspective so that you avoid your own bias. I think a good public defender leader has to recognize the difference between a technical problem and an adaptive problem, know the difference. Another characteristic of an effective public defender leader is the ability to communicate, and that's communicate externally and internally. It's one of their primary roles. I think an effective public defender leader has to have a vision, has to know where they're going. As opposed to just being a manager of whatever exists, they have to know where they want to go. They need to be collaborative. They need to work with lots and lots and lots of people, including people they used not to work well with, corrections, the police, prosecutors. I think they have to be change and reform minded. Again, they're not managers. They're leaders, and there are lots of problems that need to be solved. And that means you need to change things. I think they need to be persistent because you're constantly pushing a rock up a hill that keeps rolling backwards. They need to be honest, thick-skinned. They need to be humble. They need to be politically savvy because the landscape is constantly changing, and they're not a great deal of natural supporters. It's not like representing Mothers Against Drunk Driving. It's a very difficult job to hold. And then I think they need to be very strategic, effective at developing strategy and seeing the long term.
Tell us about you starting the leadership education in the legislative update.
Leadership education was I soon began to think that one of the primary roles of the public advocate was developing what I called a long bench. And by that, that's a baseball metaphor, but I meant that we need people who can step up into leadership. And particularly if we were going to have an effective trial division with an effective full-time system, we needed people who were going to be able to lead at the local level. And too often in the past, we elevated the best trial lawyer to become the leader of a local office rather than somebody who was actually a leader, somebody who had all those characteristics that I talked about. And so if we're going to do that, we needed to develop leadership. I've been interested in leadership for a long, long time, even before I became a lawyer. And in DPA, Ed has been a sort of the leader of developing leadership. I mean, in the early 90s, Ed began to, train on Stephen Covey and TQM and things like that. And so out of that, and I think Ed and I both decided that we needed to start holding regular leadership training, and we developed a concept of bringing our leaders in periodically. We called it the quarterly leadership for some reason, because we only met three times a year usually. But anyway, starting probably 98, 99, we started having quarterly leaderships, and we did that from then until now. We also began to periodically train on leadership over several days, where we would bring people in from outside to talk about leadership. What was the other part of that question?
In the legislative update?
As we already talked about, the advocate was our primary method for communicating. But when I became public advocate, the advocate was published six times a year. It was primarily a substantive criminal justice magazine. And even though Ed had used it over the years to drive public policy in a particular way, I thought that we needed a legislative update that would have a smaller group of people to whom we were communicating, primarily legislators, our own public defenders, judges, people who could affect the legislature. So we began to develop the legislative update as a method for carrying our message to the legislature. Sometimes we would issue two during a legislative session because we needed to develop particular messaging. Mm-hmm. It was our primary way of messaging to the legislature.
Tell us about working with the Kentucky Bar Association.
Sometime during probably the early 2000s, it became apparent to me that we needed to develop a relationship with the Kentucky Bar Association. And we began to have the KBA come to our seminar. We created an award called the Professionalism and Excellence Award, and we would have the incoming president, I believe, of the Kentucky Bar Association present to give that award to and select the person and give that award to the person who was being awarded. We began to try to have our public defender seminar coincide with the Kentucky Bar Association seminar so that our people would be able to not only be educated but also would see the importance of being a part of the larger Bar Association. The American Bar Association has been a leader in the anti-death penalty efforts, and specifically issued a call for a moratorium back in the mid-90s, and we followed that up with calling for our own moratorium in, I believe, 1997. So again, that was a sort of a bar effort. When we organized the Blue Ribbon Group, the president of the Bar Association was a part of the Blue Ribbon Group. I think that Ed, in his 4 years, has taken collaboration with the Kentucky Bar Association to new heights. We certainly started working with the Bar Association. It has perfected that particular advocacy method.
Tell us about the call for the moratorium on the death penalty and you creating the death penalty training manual.
DPA has long... One of the primary characteristics of the department has been its opposition to the death penalty. The DPA was organized in 1972-73, right after Furman versus Georgia, when we had no death penalty. Gregg versus Georgia and Roberts and the other cases came in 1976, reestablishing the constitutionality of the death penalty. And in a special session, December 22nd of 1976, the Kentucky General Assembly met and reestablished the Kentucky death penalty. The Death Penalty Task Force was established then. Ed was its chair. There were a number of us who worked, in addition to our appellate cases, to work on the effort to oppose the death penalty. Some of the things that the Death Penalty Task Force did was that we organized the first death penalty training. My memory is it was in Shakertown, and I think Morris Dees and Courtney Mullins and others helped us train there. We also had John Carroll. We had Dennis Volsky. We developed a death penalty manual. And if you go back and look at the old death penalty manual from, I think, 78, 79, the one with the black and white death penalty chair on the electric chair on the front of it, it's really an excellent manual. If you remember the kind of trial system we had at the time, we didn't have full-time lawyers in the trial arena except in Louisville and Lexington and Boyd County. So we needed to educate a group of lawyers who didn't try death penalty cases. We used the manual and we used the death penalty training for the primary ways that we would educate our trial attorneys on how to fight the death penalty. Long about, and we talked some about the local assistance branch. Local assistance branch also began to try death penalty cases. And I, for example, tried my first case in 1978, was a capital case out in Madisonville. Handled four or five capital cases out in western Kentucky when I was a baby lawyer. Ed handled several death cases as part of the local assistance branch. We all did. And we were learning about not only how to try death penalty cases, but also how to train on it, how to educate on it. Out of that, in the mid-80s, grew the capital trial branch, but it wasn't called that at the time. Remember what
Major
it was called?
Litigation.
Major litigation section. And that was during Paul Isaac's time, and that represented really a theory, a method for how to approach the death penalty. We realized that if you could beat the death penalty at the trial level, that was the way to go. And so the emphasis was on identifying the worst cases and getting the resources to that bad case. And that's held true. If you look at the size of our death penalty, you'll see that we've kept people off death row over the years. We don't have a big death row. We've only executed one person involuntarily. So that when I became public advocate, that I agreed with what we had been doing over time. And internally, if you remember, Allison was let go partly because, or she was not reappointed partly because of her opposition to the death warrants that Paul Patton had signed. I needed to communicate publicly, both internally and externally, that we remained committed to our death penalty effort. And the ABA had just issued its call for a moratorium, so I issued a call for a moratorium, which told my people that I was still against the death penalty, that we were going to continue to battle the death penalty. It also told everybody in the criminal justice system that we were independent. We were going to have our own independent voice on the death penalty.
I see the importance there. Also, what was the importance as far as bringing back the regional managers? I think that's something you said Public Advocate Conley got rid of. What was the importance of that?
I was part of the original group of directing attorneys in 1986 who met at the Pumpkin Creek Lodge in Lake Cumberland. We felt, and there were probably 13, 14 of us at the time, we felt like we were unsupervised. We were sort of out there by ourselves. We didn't really know anything that was going on. So we asked Paul Isaacs to have a supervisor, somebody who could be at meetings here in Frankfurt and advocate for our interests. So Paul Isaacs agreed with that, instituted the regional manager system. so that when Allison eliminated it, that was one of the things I wanted to bring back in when I became public advocate. I believe in supervision. I believe that directing attorneys needed oversight. They needed to have somebody guide them to act as a middle person between the public advocate and leadership in Frankfurt and delivering trial services at the local level. So that's why I brought that in and why I think it's a good model. We borrowed it, by the way. We didn't really borrow it in 86, but when I brought it back in, I looked at Minnesota's system, and they have 10 regions with a manager who is sort of one of the co-managers of the criminal justice system in the counties there, and I use that as the same model for our regional manager system.
Another thing you had touched on, you mentioned the juvenile post-disposition branch. What was the importance of that branch being created, and what hand did you have in that?
During Allison Conley's tenure, a lawsuit had been filed by the Children's Law Center. And out of that came a consent decree that established the constitutional right to access to the courts by juveniles in Kentucky. Some money was given from the Justice Cabinet to DPA to as part of that consent decree. So it was really Allison Conley and Rebecca DiLoretto who birthed, if you will, the what became the juvenile post-disposition branch. When I reorganized the department, I brought that entity into sort of a formal place in our organization with regularized funding. It parlayed nicely then into our emphasis on development of juvenile laws and expertise, so that we had juvenile law experts at the trial level, but we also had juvenile law experts in the juvenile post-disposition branch. They ended up writing the juvenile law manual. They ended up being the primary teachers of regarding juvenile law. Gail Robinson, Tim Arnold, Rebecca DiLoretto, and others really held up juvenile law as a specialty and built that. They began to conduct juvenile summits throughout the Commonwealth on a regular basis so that attorneys and new attorneys who were coming into the department would be trained on juvenile law. So that's played a real important role in the development of juvenile law in our department. Similar to Fawbush, it's sort of the soul of juvenile law, JPDB has been.
Okay. With all these changes, what as far as keeping accurate records on all the clients, how was there any changes made with that, or how did you keep those?
I think over the years we've realized increasingly the importance of objective data, tying our workload into something that was objective, and that certainly began before me. I mean, we had a guy in the department named Bill Curtis who used to advocate for and analyze our caseload data. We have national standards, national advisory commission standards of how many cases you can do in a particular year. Ed has written on caseloads. The American Council of Chief Defenders that I chaired and Ed is now chair of has established a statement on workloads and caseloads. The American Bar Association has issued a formal opinion, 06441, on caseloads. You cannot be effective at advocating for increased funding using caseload data unless you have good caseload data, unless it's accurate. If your caseload data is inaccurate or your caseload data is not thorough, then you're going to falter when you try to make an objective case. You're just going to be making an emotional case for why you need more funding. So I am one of a number of people, and Ed continues this to this day, advocating for solid, accurate caseload data that measures how many cases we have and what our workload is.
And speaking of national organizations, what different national organizations, public defender organizations, were you actually involved in during your tenure?
Well, we've talked already about KCDL. KCDL is a part of the larger organization of NACDL. We also have consistently been a part of the National Legal Aid and Defender Association. National Legal Aid and Defender Association had something in the late 90s called the National Defender Leadership Institute, the NDLI, where they trained that generation of public defenders in collaboration with the Vera Institute, that has helped a whole bunch of us learn how to be public defender leaders. Out of NLADA grew the Chief Defender Roundtable. Out of the Chief Defender Roundtable grew the American Council on Chief Defenders. I was chair of that in 2006 and 2007, and Ed is now chair of that. I've also been part of the National Criminal Defense College, which is an outgrowth of NACDL, Southern Public Defender Training Center, which I got on their board right as I was leaving being public advocate.
Some public advocates have been very involved nationally in public defender organizations. Others have not. Why did you see it so important to be involved so much nationally?
I think it's vital that the public advocate of Kentucky be involved nationally, primarily for his or her own growth. If you see the world only from the Kentucky perspective, your vision is going to be limited. I learned so much going to NLADA conferences and other conferences where I was exposed to what other defenders were doing. If you look at the full-time method, if you look at use of caseload data, use of workloads, the emphasis on training, the emphasis on the whole client, all of that came from looking at the world from different perspectives. If you just look at your own parochial problems, you're not going to be able to move the agency forward. So I'm a huge believer in the Kentucky public advocate being a part of that. I will also say that in 1972, when our statute was written, it was one of the most progressive statutes in the nation. We have a good reputation as a leading public defender organization. That reputation is at its peak right now, and part of the reason is our involvement in national organizations.
What were some of the memorable cases that took place during your term?
Most of the Chapter 31 cases had been litigated by the time that I became a public advocate. Certainly the McQueen case was a memorable case, and we've talked about that. There were a number of developments on the death penalty during my tenure. You think of the elimination of the death penalty for the persons with mental retardation, Atkins. You think of the elimination of the death penalty for juveniles, and that's the Simmons case. You think of the raising of the standard of representation, and that would be Rumpilla and Wiggins and cases like that. In terms of our own department, among the memorable cases would be Bays versus Reese, the lethal injection case that we got cert granted on, and Padilla versus Kentucky, which was right at the end of my tenure, I think. Which established in a very significant case the obligation of counsel to advise clients about immigration status, and in a larger way to advise about collateral consequences to a guilty plea. So
you had, under your term, there were clemency cases by Governor Patton and Governor Fletcher.
Yeah, there were two clemencies that were granted, as I recall. The first of them was Kevin Stanford, who had, if you go back to the late 80s, Kevin Stanford case was a case that said you could get the death penalty if you were under the age of 18. And then after Simmons came down, Kevin Stanford was... Maybe before Simmons came down, Kevin Stanford was granted clemency by Governor Patton because he was a juvenile at the time that he was convicted and sentenced to death, and also because he was a changed man. And then Slaughter, I guess, was the second clemency. There was a man named Slaughter, who actually was not named Slaughter. The trial lawyer didn't know his name at all.
Leonard?
His name is Leonard. And Governor Fletcher and his general counsel was appalled by the quality of representation that occurred in that case, where the lawyer didn't even know his client's name and allowed him to go under the name of Slaughter. And so clemency was granted there. There's an appalling number of people in Kentucky's death row whose private lawyers, mostly, have been disbarred or disciplined, and Slaughter was certainly one of those.
And Governor, were you involved with any of the commutations related to the
domestic violence? When I became public advocate, Marguerite Thomas had worked, along with Allison Conley and others, extensively to get women who had been involved in domestic violence situations to get their sentences, to get them eligible for parole. When Paul Patton left office, everybody associated with that case thought that he was going to grant clemency to a lot of those women. Nobody ever really knew what happened, but he did not, by and large, grant clemency. And some of those women were granted relief later, but I don't remember the details of it.
In July 2008, Dan Goyette and you became plaintiffs in a case. Can you tell us a little about that?
Right. In 2008, what had been happening repeatedly when we got more money was that our caseloads would go up and they would continue to be excessive. And in 2006, the American Bar Association had issued an opinion, formal opinion 06441, saying that it was unethical for public defenders to handle excessive caseloads, that public defender supervisors, public defender leaders could be, had to ensure that their lawyers were providing ethical representation. In 2008, then, I proposed a budget that would have reduced our caseloads down to a level that I thought would restore an ethical level. The governor's budget did not do that. So that as the 2008 General Assembly developed it, I began to communicate that unless they did something, we were going to continue to have an unethical caseload, and that we were going to have to take steps to follow 06441. The budget that came out of the House was consistent with the governor's budget. So I communicated in the Senate and in the Court of Justice that if we didn't get a better budget, we were not going to be able to represent everybody. I began to start saying that a budget document purchased certain level of legal representation, and we couldn't do more than they paid for. As part of that budget, we were taking over the Lexington Public Defender Office. We had recently been charged with establishing in a state public defender's office in Lexington, replacing the old Fayette County Legal Aid. And part of the process, part of the budget process, was that we needed more money to make that office a fully functioning office. Once the House budget got to the Senate, David Williams and Robert Stivers decided that we were not being truthful about our needs in Lexington, and they decided to cut our budget by several million dollars. It was clear to me at that time that if they cut our budget by $7 million, that the Rubicon had been crossed over. We would no longer be able to sustain full representation, that we were going to have to do something. So we informed them that if they maintained that budget, that we would start restricting services. We informed the Court of Justice likewise. They went ahead with our budget cut. I believe our cut was down to something like $38 or $39 million. And so we announced a service restriction plan that was going to be effective July 1st. We began to meet as an agency. Our directing attorneys began to meet on how we were going to implement that plan. We decided that we would no longer represent certain classes of cases, and those were Class B misdemeanors, family court, probation and parole revocations, and other classes of people who were not typically going to prison. As part of that, we then decided to file an extraordinary action, a lawsuit, using some civil lawyers who were representing us pro bono to establish the right to turn away certain cases. And that was filed in late June. I had previously announced my retirement for September of 2008. Between the filing of the lawsuit, and which was in June of 2008, and my retirement in September, 100% of my time and a lot of the percentage of our leadership team's time was spent on going to court, implementing the service restriction plan, going to hearings where prosecutors and judges were challenging our right to restrict services. Eventually, I retired, and when you do the oral history of Ed Monahan, you'll have to take it up from there. But eventually, I know that an injunction was entered where the service restriction plan had to end. So I handed the torch off to Ed, and Ed continued to lead on that lawsuit as of September of 2008.
Can you tell us a little bit about Ex Parte Farley?
Well, it's interesting that you end with the lawsuit, and I began with Ex Parte Farley. It's sort of bookends of my life with DPA. I became a lawyer in 1977, November, and I was part of the Death Penalty Task Force. And the new law, the new death penalty statute, 532.025, and couple of statutes after that, established as part of constitutionality, to be constitutional, we thought there had to be, this case had to be proportional to other similarly situated cases. And so the Supreme Court of Kentucky was charged with the obligation of collecting data in capital cases. Well, Ed and I were representing Eugene Gall. Our department was representing everybody on death row. It wasn't a very big death row. But we decided that in order to effectively represent our clients in those cases, we needed access to the data so we could argue from the data that our clients were disproportional, that the death penalty against them was arbitrary under the Eighth Amendment, Eighth and Fourteenth Amendments. So we convinced our public advocate, Jack Farley, to file the action in his name. And I think that initially it was Farley versus John Palmore or the Kentucky Supreme Court. Eventually they renamed it Ex Parte Farley. But it was a very contentious case. My memory of that is that at the oral argument, they had the Kentucky State Police standing by in case there was violence or rioting or something. I recall John Palmore and Justice Lukowski being exceptionally rude to Jack Farley, who argued the case. Did we ask Jack about arguing Ex Parte Farley? I bet we didn't. That would be interesting to have his memories of that. But anyway, the case came down. The Kentucky Supreme Court slammed us. I believe I was counsel. Kevin McNally was counsel. I don't know if you were counsel as well. You probably helped with the pleadings. It was one of our most contentious times, but it was also one of our proudest times, where we were standing up for the right of our death row clients to due process of law at the beginning, really, of our agency.
What are you most proud of accomplishing?
One thing or...
Whatever you are most proud of. If it's more than one.
I'm proud of raising funding. When I began as public advocate, our funding was at $16 million and prosecutors were getting $48 million, so they were getting three times what we were getting. We got it to where we were getting over a little over half, where around $40 million and they were getting around $70 million, so we lowered the disparity. Mm-hmm. I was proud of that. Efforts at lowering caseloads, higher salaries. Probably I'm proudest of our developing the full-time system and completing that in 2005. I think we became a more professional agency. I think we became more client-centered during my time. Proud of the physical upgrades in all the full-time offices. We moved out of terrible locations like the courthouse in Bowling Green or a furnace room in Paintsville, or we even had a mobile home that we were going to move into. There was the Stanton office that we were talking about earlier was located in a lumber yard, and the smell of creosote was everywhere. We've upgraded that. We upgraded that considerably during our 12 years, and I know Ed is continuing to upgrade with the 2020 plan. And I think that's really important. I wanted clients, poor people, to come into our offices and know that they were being treated like middle class people were being treated. That they were a place. They were at a law firm. They weren't at some public welfare agency being treated like an object, but rather they were somebody worthy of dignity. So I was proud of that. Proud of the Lexington office that came with considerable political capital being used, the Innocence Project, the rewrite of it of Chapter 31, and Ed, by the way, was the author of that rewrite. We only had one involuntary execution. I think that's extraordinary in the Bible Belt over all that period of time. I think we became a player at the General Assembly where we were respected on policy matters, criminal justice matters, the elevation of juvenile representation, elevating education, whether it's new attorney training, directing attorney training, leadership training, FAWBush, the advocate. I mean, we really developed education as a national reputation for education. Ed was the training director for a long period of time, including when I was public advocate, and he really put Kentucky education on the map. I was proud of surviving during a Republican administration. I mean, I was appointed by a Democrat and then reappointed by a Republican, and surviving during those times and really developing allies in the Republican administration, from Stan Cave to David Fleener and eventually to Ernie Fletcher. And then finally developing our independence, where we had a memorandum of agreement with the Justice Cabinet, I think, was really important. So I look back over those 12 years as having real solid accomplishments.
What's given you so much energy to be for public defender work?
It really goes back to the late 60s, and I was inspired by John Kennedy, and I was inspired by the war on poverty. I was a VISTA volunteer and saw how poor people live. I saw nascent poverty lawyers before the Legal Services Corporation standing up for poor people in court, standing up for their dignity. If you were in the 60s, you either decided to throw a bomb or do something productive, and I decided to do something productive, and that carried, and then once you get into the system, you see all the injustice, so that drives you every day. Every day you go to get your brains beat out in court, that drives you to make it better. If you ever have a client you're convinced is innocent, have to go to prison, that drives you to make sure it doesn't happen again. So that's what gave me energy over the years.
And those over three decades, what case that you were the lawyer for the client stands out?
Two cases, really. One, I was involved with you, and that's in the Eugene Gall case where, as baby lawyers, we took his appeal, one of the first people placed on death row. And we lost through the first seven stages and finally won the case in 2000, I think, in the Sixth Circuit. And he's now off death row serving a life sentence in Ohio. And the second case would be Martin Mendoza Tovar, a capital case I tried in Richmond, where two Clark County farmers were gunned down by three migrant workers, immigrants from Mexico, three brothers. And my client ended up with 4 years. The offer had been life without parole for 25 years. And he got 4 years on a reckless homicide. And that was probably my biggest, my best feeling of an individualized accomplishment, an individual client.